After a one-week hiatus, welcome to the resumption of the current federal tax developments, this time for the week of October the 22nd, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state CPA societies. This week, we're going to do it a little differently. I decided last week I skipped because I had all kinds of end of tax season returns to file. I'd been on the road quite a bit doing sessions. And I came back, had a lot of end of tax season things. Some clients cleaned things up. Some things got solved. One big issue for one client finally got resolved. We had to get that return done. So it's one of those things you all can recognize right at the end of tax season. And then this past week, and actually coming into the next week, I've got lots of travel on the East Coast. And I'm having to come back and forth across the country. And as you may be aware, being able to sit in a plane and write isn't the easiest thing one can do in a coach seat in an aircraft. So I'm having a little trouble getting all the documents written that would normally go up on the website. So this week you'll discover we don't have write-ups except for one update where we're having a write-up, but I am going to cover other developments. That's not really a problem. I can cover that. And we're also going to have a copy, if you download the documents for this week, of the proposed regulations, which are the big thing we're going to talk about this week, the proposed regulations in the qualified opportunity zones. But let's talk about the various things we're talking about this week. We're going to have a case of a pastor who was claiming that a portion of, we won't call it income right away. I don't want to bias it too much to start, but that his members of his congregation were giving him money that they did not want him to pay tax on, which they did not want to deduct. And he was claiming that those should represent non-deductible gifts. We'll talk about how the court looked at that and the cases where, which the court pointed out, where a minister could qualify for having non-taxable income in a situation like that, and the cases where they couldn't. We'll talk about the IRS granting filing and payment relief to those affected by Hurricane Michael. We'll also talk about a case where a taxpayer who was trying to apply a payment to a specific part of his unpaid tax liability got basically cut off by the IRS, who liened the account after the check had been written, but before the IRS got the check. And that caused the check to bounce, which of course, now the IRS applied what was effectively the same funds, but they applied them against the payments they wanted to pay, not the ones that this person wanted the things applied against. So we'll talk about, does that work? And finally, I want to have a discussion, which is probably the biggest thing this week, of some of the key elements that were in the Qualified Opportunity Zone proposed regulations issued on October 19th. Those regulations, which go into a whole lot of areas, they're not everything for Qualified Opportunity Zone issues. I want to talk about some of the key developments there, some of the key issues, because I know a lot of people have been waiting. They haven't invested in such funds, or the funds haven't been able to get started because of unanswered questions. These proposed regulations will answer a lot of the questions. Generally, they can be relied upon. There is a detailed description of how and when you can rely on them in the regulations. But we'll talk about what we found out in these regulations, and we'll also talk a little bit about how those opportunity zone investments work. Let's start out with our first case for this week. And the first thing we'll talk about this week is a case, the one we just mentioned, of the pastoral offerings. This case is the case of Felton versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2018-168. It was issued on October the 10th. This involved a minister, Reverend Felton. And Reverend Felton, early on in his training, in fact, when he was basically studying to enter the ministry and he was doing work in churches, you know, new people who are training for the ministry often, you know, take internships, etc., in churches. So he began to learn the ropes. And he discovered in the evangelical style churches that he was going to be preaching in that there was this tradition of what's called handshake money. And handshake money, for those of you, you know, many of us are probably aware of this if you've attended a church, you know, many churches, what happens is you finish, you know, the service is over, the pastor goes to the back of the church as people are leaving, and people, you know, meets and greets the congregation. I shouldn't say, you know, basically shakes their hand, talks to them as they leave the church. Well, in these congregations, what people would do as they came up to shake the pastor's hand is they would pass over money to the pastor. Now, Reverend Felton didn't like this, as the court tells us. They don't tell us exactly why he didn't like this, but there are a couple of reasons that seem kind of obvious that I suspect bother him in this case. Number one, he probably felt that it really kind of, you know, lacked some control over how people were paying the pastor. But number two, it also kind of put pressure on people in line. You know, if you see five people in front of you, shake the hand of the pastor and hand the pastor money, that kind of puts pressure on you when you come up to shake the hand of the pastor that apparently one's supposed to hand him money. And he didn't feel that that was something that should be encouraged. So he tried to develop a system to get around that. He basically decided as a, you know, as a young up and coming pastor, he decided that when he got his church, he would go ahead and find a way to get rid of the handshake money issue. But he discovered a problem. It was a long-standing tradition in the church. Initially, he came up with the concept of the white envelope system. And we'll talk about, he had an envelope system. We'll talk about his white envelopes and his blue envelopes here in just a second. On the white envelopes, and a lot of churches do this, you know, the envelope itself has categories where you can designate what your contribution should be used for. So, for instance, you give money to the church. You may say, I want this to go for capital improvements. I want this to go for missionaries. I want this to go for, you know, whatever, the youth. Well, they put a line on there called pastoral. And pastoral was to be, these are funds that were given because handshake money was meant for the minister only, to go to the minister. So if you wanted to make a contribution and have it go to the minister, you could designate it as pastoral. In fact, you know, Reverend Felton did not actually take the salary, any specific salary from the church. What he took in payment was the pastoral amounts that were paid over. So people could fill that in. But he discovered that some people grumbled about that because they came up and said, Pastor, when I do this, it's a pure gift. I'm not going to claim a tax deduction for this. That's not my point. I don't want to claim a tax deduction. I want all of this money to go to you and to be used by you. So because of that, he set up a second set of envelopes, the blue envelopes. Now, here's how it worked in the church. Whenever the offering came up in the sermon, you know, the pastor would talk regularly about the need to tithe and the, you know, the idea of, you know, giving your proper percentage, your 10%, for those of you who remember that, you know, you're going to give your 10%. He would make all that comments about tithing, and this was all tied to the white envelopes. And when the offering came up every Sunday, the ushers would basically have and be waving white envelopes, and it would hand them out to anybody, you know, and they were open offered. The pastor made it clear you could request a white envelope that allowed you to designate where it would go, and that would also allow the church to keep a record of what you had given so they could give you your receipt at the end of the year that you need in order to claim your deduction. So that was, you know, regular issue. The blue envelopes were never handed out in that form. Individuals had to, while the ushers apparently had blue envelopes, individual members had to ask the ushers for them. You know, if you needed a blue envelope, well, like when you came into the church, you'd say, you'd say, hi, Joe, you know, shake the usher's hand, say, hi, Joe, oh, give me a blue envelope for this week, right? I need a blue envelope. And the blue envelopes did not have the donor's name. The blue envelopes were designated clearly, and they stated on them, were designated and go to the pastor. Now, in the year in question, you know, we're talking about this, the pastor received $40,000 of pastoral offerings that came in through the white envelopes and about $200,000 that came in through the blue envelopes. The pastor reported the $40,000 on the white envelope donations as compensation, but he did not report as income the $200,000 that he received from the blue envelopes. The blue envelope income was left off his return. He took the position that the blue envelope should qualify as gifts to him. That was the intent of the congregation. You know, the congregation was, you know, they were not deducting it. At least they said they weren't. And they weren't getting the receipts to allow them to make the deduction. And the $40,000 for those who went through the white envelopes, that he picked up as income. The IRS said, we don't like that. That's not how this should work. So we went to the tax court. And this issue comes up quite often in churches, okay? And what the tax court did was looked at a four-factor test. And this four-factor test first looks at The first S is, were the donations objectively provided in exchange for services? Well, that test came out in favor of them being taxable because the court said very clearly people were paying this hoping that Pastor Felton, who is a very engaging, very good pastor, you know, he built a very large church, actually has a bunch of satellite churches as well that relate around him. You know, they paid this so that Reverend Felton would stay and continue to provide services. They're paying him because he is preaching and giving them the intangible religious benefit we all heard about on the, you know, when we give receipts for the charitable contribution from the church. They said, so that factor leans in favor of compensation. The second test is whether the cleric or other church authorities requested these donations be made to the pastor. The court found in that case that actually favored saying they weren't compensation because the pastor, Reverend, very clearly, you know, never requested anybody make a blue envelope contribution. He rarely mentioned the white envelope contributions all throughout the church services, but he never mentioned the blue envelopes. The ushers did not provide white blue envelopes unless you specifically came to them and asked them for a blue envelope. So they said, look, basically, you know, the church is not pushing on people the blue envelope system. The blue envelope system is not being requested. It was established at the request of church members. And so that argues in favor of a gift. Next is a question of, you know, whether donations were part of highly structured program given by individual church members or the congregation as a whole. The court said, well, this really argues in favor of compensation because they said the donations from year to year on the blue envelopes were very consistent within 10% of an amount each year. The court said that certainly suggested strongly, even though we don't know for sure who gave each blue envelope each Sunday, that a whole bunch of the congregation regularly gave consistently similar amount. You know, they basically every week they gave a blue envelope and it was in about the same amount. It wasn't like they gave it due to a special occasion or some sort of special issue that happened or some special need the pastor might have had. They simply gave it routinely as part of their donations. The blue envelope system itself helped the routine keep going, right? That was a way to do it with the routine. And then they said, finally, did the cleric receive a separate salary from the church and the amount of that salary in comparison to personal donations? In this case, he actually refused the direct salary from the church. But if we count the $40,000 white envelope amount of salary, that's still significantly less. And even including his housing allowance, it was still significantly less than the $200,000 that he got from the blue envelopes. That also argued in favor of compensation. At the end of the day, the court decided, applying the four-factor test, that it appears this should be taxable income. Now, this is something that we see quite often with churches, and indirectly, we sometimes see it in non-church context. The idea being, well, if the person paying it doesn't take a deduction, then the person receiving it shouldn't have to pick it up as income. There's nothing in the tax law that allows for that. In this case, and churches, we see this quite often, they may be called love offerings. They may be called, you know, there are various terms the church will use for this. Now, the case does go through cases where it could be excluded. For instance, they talked about cases where a special offering was voluntarily put together by members of the church to pay a retiring pastor a stipend, because to pay a retiring pastor, give him a contribution because they felt that, you know, what he had to retire on wouldn't be sufficient. That was held to be non-taxable in a prior case. Also, a pastor who, you know, became gravely ill and where there were major medical expenses. You know, the congregation, you know, and he was never going to be able to preach again. The congregation raised money to cover his medical, you know, and they did that voluntarily, people did. And the court said in those cases, that's fine. Those look like gifts. And those look like gifts because, to be totally honest, and this was a key issue for the court, these people were giving donations knowing there would never be another service rendered. In essence, this person was going to be no longer rendering services to the church or even incapable of rendering the service to the church. They're saying that worked. But if you give every Sunday, the pastor is receiving these love offerings or pastoral offerings or handshake money, that's income. Now, of course, the practical side of this is I don't doubt that some churches will read this and decide they're really going to keep handshake money, right? And then handshake money just won't be reported. That's a potential problem if you know the minister is receiving such funds and you're preparing the tax return. It's also a problem if you are involved in the church and you are, let's say, a board member or anyway involved with the payroll reports, because you know you also know that there should be some wages reported here that's not being reported, not going on the W-2. That is a problem potentially in this case. So yeah, you got issues with that. But it is an interesting case, and you know it's interesting also because you might think initially the answer is going to be, oh, clearly it's taxable, there's no question. No, the court really went through this in detail. There are implications here, and they certainly tell you with the four-test system that it's not just clearly always going to be compensation. But as I say, please remember, the mere fact somebody doesn't take a deduction doesn't make it not taxable. You know, the people who you're doing returns for this year, you know, the people you did the returns for last year individually who don't have a trade or business, not going to be able to deduct, they won't be claiming a deduction for the won't be claiming a deduction for, you know, the tax return. So because of that, you know, basically that doesn't mean it's not taxable to us. Same difference. Okay, some issues that came up this week. Anybody in the Florida Panhandle area affected by Hurricane Michael, IRS News Relief 2018-199 that came out on September 12th, just before the October 15th deadline, pushed the due date back to February 28th. That's a month later than we had for the prior hurricane, for any deadlines that normally would occur from October 7th to February 28th of 2019. Okay, so for instance, like the October 15th tax return, that could be filed as late as February 28th if you're in the affected area, and you basically would get relief. If you are in a disaster, in one of the disaster areas that are proclaimed disaster areas by FEMA, you should be automatically identified. If not, the service tells you how to contact them. If you are not living in that area, but had books and records in that area, otherwise were affected, there is a way to approach the IRS individually for relief in this area. The payroll tax deposit date was pushed back to October the 22nd. That date's already passed, of course, but basically, you know, or will pass. It's, you know, it's the day this is coming out. But those deposits need to be made by then, but they're not late if made by then. As always, in a case like this, be sure to check for the final list of affected areas. The affected areas, the counties, et cetera, that are named as disaster areas, always kind of moves around a bit in these disasters. Sometimes counties get added very late in the process to the disaster area. So you want to make sure you check and see if your client's in the affected area. And if they're not in the affected area, but they were affected, you want to go ahead and find the method, read the news release, and get the way that you're going to be able to ask the IRS for relief in this case. Next case up is a case of Mulaski versus Commissioner, 151 TC number 9, issued on October the 10th. This is kind of an interesting case because it's kind of like, well, you know, that didn't seem fair, but it is. A lot of times when you owe the government money, and Mulaski's owed them for a number of years, especially if you have trust fund penalties, trust fund payments. When you make a payment of taxes to the federal government, you know, if you make a payment on what you owe taxes, penalties, interest. If you're paying trust fund taxes, you know, something where there's some trust fund taxes in there, we're going to really, really, really want to make sure that the payment goes to the trust fund taxes, not to the penalties and interest. But in order for that to be done, we have to make a voluntary payment. If you make a payment that is considered to be non-voluntary, or let's say the IRS takes the money, then the IRS will apply the payment where they want to apply it. They can apply it wherever they want to. And I guarantee you, trust fund money is going to be the last thing they're going to apply the payment against. Now, what happened in this case was the taxpayers had written a check. They were designated payments for specific time periods and specific types of taxes. After that check was written, but apparently before it got to the IRS, the IRS executed a levy. They levied the bank account, took the money out of it. So obviously, when the check got to the IRS tried to deposit it, it bounced. The taxpayer said, wait, clearly that's a voluntary payment. We had the check. We'd released the check prior to the levy. the IRS, obviously, you know, this shouldn't count. In essence, we should be able to designate that payment. Now, there were a lot of other collection due process issues in this case, but this was kind of the key one on the reported. The tax court found that it was not a voluntary payment. It wasn't a payment as part of the problem. And you couldn't make the levy a voluntary payment by extension. One of the key issues here is going to be, and it's generally why this isn't going to work, is the court's going to point out that it wasn't like the IRS the day after the tax, didn't get paid, showed up, levied the account, and walked out. There was time in between for you to have made the payment. The fact that you delayed so long that the IRS was in the process of and obtained the levy, that's tough luck. You've got to beat the levy. You've got to get the money to the IRS before they levy out the bank account. If you don't do that, the IRS has the right, and they do the levy, they have the right to take the money and apply it where they wish. The court didn't find bad faith in this case. The court said simply, you got to beat them. If you don't beat them, it's not a voluntary not a voluntary payment, and it cannot be applied based solely upon what you decide. Let's hit the big thing for this week, okay? Proposed regulations for the opportunity zones, qualified opportunity zones. This is Reg 115-42018. It was published October 19th. The fun part about this, I had just finished discussing for a firm. I was doing a Tax Cuts and Jobs Act session for a firm last week. I told you I've been on the East Coast. So I was just doing that Friday. And basically what happened was we were doing it just about 11 o'clock in the morning on Friday. And I talked about opportunity zones. I said we didn't have regs, but we expected them to come out soon because we knew they'd left the Office of Management and Budget, but we hadn't seen them yet. And what happened was I sat down then, we started lunch, I opened up my phone, and tax analysts told me, like, time-stamped 11:18 a.m., the proposed regulations on the opportunity zones were issued. So they were issued. Didn't have time to read them over lunch in detail and go over them in detail in that class. We basically discussed them briefly and, talked about, look, you want to go take a look at them. The full copy of these regs is in the download material for this week. And I have gone through, which I always do with regs like this, and I put Acrobat bookmarks into the file. So for me, at least, this makes a copy of the regs that I'm able to cross-reference and use a lot easier. Because it's really easy to bounce back and forth between the preamble explaining what the IRS is planning doing here than the actual reg language. It's a lot easier to bounce around that way. The problem is the IRS does not put them out with bookmarks. Actually, there is one in there for the Paperwork Reduction Act section, which is probably the one section of that document you will never read or ever care to read. You're not going to find any tax rules sitting in there. But that's the only bookmark in there. I put a full bookmark version there. It's at the back of this week's file. So you can go ahead and grab it from there. If you just want the reg with the bookmark, we've got that on the currentfiletaxdevelopments.com site. These are regulations issued under IRC 1400Z-2. Okay, they relate to that. There are a number of reserved areas, and there's going to be additional guidance coming out in a lot of areas here. But the whole qualified opportunity zone credits, or not credit, but qualified opportunity zone under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is a huge opportunity to defer recognition of gain. If you take your gain on sale, and within 180 days, put that gain into a qualified opportunity fund. If you do that, then that gain is not currently taxable. Won't be taxable until you dispose of the opportunity fund investment or the opportunity fund ceases to be an opportunity fund because it doesn't meet the requirements. If you hold it for 5 years, we get rid of 10% of that of that deferred gain disappears. Hold it for 7 years, another 5% disappears. But if you hold it for 10 years or more, you can elect when you sell the opportunity zone fund to have the basis of the fund be set equal to the sales price. Now, those elections are only open if you do it with gains. You have to reinvest gains. If you buy into this fund with any other fund, none of these special rules apply. You can hold it for 40 years. We don't care. You're going to pay tax regular gains when you do it. But being able to escape tax entirely. So I might have, let's say I'm, you know, I am now selling off. I've had my Intel stock since 1965. I'm selling it now, and I'm triggering this huge gain, right? If you had Intel stock, 65 is probably a little early, but if you had Intel stock from back in the days when you're doing traffic light controllers, and you've held it to today, you're going to have one interesting level of gain, even if you didn't have too many shares to start with. And so let's say I've got this $3 million gain. I can take that $3 million, put in an opportunity zone fund, keep it in there for 10 years. And at the end of 10 years, I can then sell that fund, or after the 10 years, any point after that, I could sell that fund and be able to totally defer the gain. Never pay tax on the gain. So it's a great opportunity with one huge caveat. You better find a good investment for your opportunity fund, because A, that's all great, $2 million, no tax. But if that's only worth $2 million after 10 years, your lost earnings on that are going to more than wipe out the 20% capital gains tax, or 23.8% capital gains tax you would have paid had you paid tax on it. If you'd have paid tax, got down 23.8%, but then invested those funds, they would have grown way past the $2 million over those 10 years, you know, if you had a reasonable rate of return. So the catch is, as always, don't get so fascinated with the tax benefits to ignore the economic benefits. You know, you really need to kind of good. I've always found it's best to just take a deep breath, go to Excel, run real numbers, right? Let's make some real assumptions, run numbers. Let's not get all tied up in, look at that tax savings. Wow, you know, take a look at the fancy glittering thing, you know, and ignore the man behind the curtain, right? The old Wizard of Oz problem. You know, make sure we don't have that problem here. Now, the proposed regulations clarified a number of items. One key one that a lot of people have been interested in, and this one probably a lot of people aren't going to be happy with, the IRS determined that Congress intended for only capital gains to be able to be deferred. So if your client had non-capital gain income, they had ordinary income, they had anything else that is not a capital gain, wasn't treated as a capital gain, that's not going to be eligible for deferral. Okay, so 180 days, but let's say, like, you know, your client sold their operating business, it was an S corporation, all that, they could reinvest like the gain on the goodwill, because that's going to be capital gain. But all that 1245 recapture, not able to be reinvested. Only capital gains can be deferred. If you make any additional investments in the fund aside from the gain, you have to account for those separately because they don't qualify for any of the special benefits. Now, that's interesting because some people might get confused. Okay, I sold my company for $16 million, right? I sold the assets of the company and the S Corporation for $16 million. And I have this, you know, $5 million gain, capital gain. No, it's not yet to reinvest the $16 million. You just have to, you reinvest the five. And if you reinvest the $16 million, $11 million of the gain is going to be considered to be $11 million for investment will not qualify for this benefit. Only the $5 million will. Remember as well, you had to have to do it within 180 days, and the gain has to have been triggered after the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act went into play. So you have all of these crazy little rules that are in play with it. So we have these rules for it, right? And the problem has been, the clock's been running since early in the year, and just now we've finally been able to get these funds really running because now we know how they're going to work. So for a lot of people, the clock ran out, okay? If you in, but now the other problem is the qualified opportunity zone designation goes away after 2028. Well, they're saying, well, what happened? It means if I buy it this year, I've got a race to get in there. So I have for 10 years, then I have to have it sold before the end of 2028. Nope, they said, nope, that's not going to be a problem. If you invest before the program ends, the code itself was not clear, but if you invest before the program ends, you can actually sell your interest through December 31st of 2047 and can still exclude the gain. So they're not going to force you to immediately sell the property, you know, at the end of 10 years if you, you know, when you invest right now, because we barely have 10 years left. So they are going to give you what's effectively going to be 20 years to dump it, you know, or potentially if you bought it today, or 10 years to dump it if you bought it just before the program goes away. So that's going to be there. They are considering, should there be some incentive for early? You know, they understand if they said it only counts through December 31st of 2028, that's going to be kind of complicated. So this may still change, but right now it looks like we're going to be able to get the gain deferral all the way through the end of 2047. Now, if you hold it past that date, we have a problem. Okay, now, next thing. They had a rule, one of the requirements for the fund itself, substantially all tangible property must be used in the Opportunity Zone. The question was, what was substantially all? The IRS did what a lot of people think is a very taxpayer-friendly reading on that. They set that at 70% here. But there are a whole bunch of other substantially all provisions in this, some of which don't lend themselves as much to measurement. And the IRS makes it very clear. This 70% here only affects the tangible property issue, which they said there are some special unique problems with that. It does not affect the other parts of this. So the other substantially all provisions they're asking for guidance on, those are basically most of the reserve sections of these regs that were issued relate to very substantially all definitions. So you want to check that carefully. Remember, we also said we have to account for secondary contributions separately. Well, if you invest in a partnership, remember, if your percentage of liability goes up, that's deemed to be a contribution of cash by you. Is that something we have to track separately as a separate investment? The IRS and the regs gave us relief from that, saying if you have a deemed cash contribution due to 752A's, you know, redefinition of increase in liability allocated to a partner is a contribution of cash, that will not be considered to be a separate investment. It'll be considered part of, you know, the general investment that gave rise to the interest you had that had the additional liabilities allocated to it. That's nice, because it would be a concerning problem if those liabilities had generated a non-qualified gain investment. Also for partnerships, a partnership can, on its own, invest in a qualified opportunity fund. So the partnership sells, let's say, you know, they sell off their business. They have this $10 million worth of goodwill. The partnership could invest that $10 million worth of goodwill in a qualified opportunity zone fund. And if it did so, you know, the deferral would take place. The individual partners would not end up, you know, having anything to say on that. But what if the partnership decides not to do that? The partnership, you know, sells off an office building this year, or sells off investments. So they sell off, you know, securities worth $3 million. You're allocated a $600,000 gain. They didn't go for opportunity funds. You, as the individual partner, can actually, within 180 days, put your share of the gain into the qualified opportunity zone funds. Now, that's a little bit of an issue, because how do we measure 180 days? By default, 180 days starts on the year end of the partnership, which is when it comes out to you on the K-1. But if the partnership, you can elect to instead use the day the partnership made the sale. Why? Because you can't invest before the start of the 180 day period. It doesn't count. So if you know the partnership sold the asset and the partnership will compute and tell you your share of the gain, you could use that date and reinvest the funds right away and get into the fund rather than having to wait till the end of the year. So there are special rules on partnerships. Also kind of neat, and this was a bit surprising, you can use the fund ownership interest as collateral for a loan. Now, if the fund itself borrows money, right, you know, refinances, gets cash, and makes a distribution, that's a potentially disqualifying event. That's a problem. But as an owner, I can pledge my interest in the fund and borrow against that and get cash on that. That's interesting allowance, and obviously you're going to expect people to try to figure out some way to bundle that. We'll see if the IRS goes after substance over form, if all of the fund owners magically decide to pledge their interest and, you know, we get the money out. I can see that creating some potential interesting, potential maybe some opportunities, but also some controversy. So we'll just have to watch how it goes. Now, in addition to what we talked about here today, and obviously I don't want to take us too much more time, we have a bunch of operational issues that are in the regs. If you're setting up such a fund, go through these in details, right? If you're setting up, if your client's considering these, go through this in detail. There are comments on the various substantiality portions of the law. They want to know how that works, and they're asking for your comments on those. Hey, we are now in fall. It's time. CPE season is in full swing, and I know that because I'm going to be on the road all next week. And then I'm going to be coming back and I will be doing some firms next week for the most part. But then I'll be coming back on, you know, the beginning of the following week, October 29th and 30th. And I'll be in Boise, Idaho that week. And we're still available signing up Qualified Business Income on Monday. That is being webcast. So you don't have to be in Idaho. You know, you could do that if you wanted to, I guess. You could do it from anywhere. And by the way, that course also qualifies for EA credit. So if you're an EA, we should be able to get you EA credit for that one. Tuesday will be the going to be called multi-state taxation. That one does not qualify for EA credit because it's not federal taxes. Does qualify for credit for all your CPAs, right? And we have that. So if you're in Idaho, remember the Idaho Society, because you get the best prices, sign up for it. But as I said, if you're not a member of the Idaho Society, it's still available to you. You just have to pay a little bit extra to get into it. And you might look at signing up, becoming a member of the Idaho Society, if you want to take a look at their offerings. We have all those coming up, and there's a ton of other state CPA Society courses. I'll also be that week doing a session in Arizona. I'll be doing sessions at the session for updates at the at their Federal Tax Institute. I'll be appearing in Portland, Oregon, for their tax conference for the Oregon Society. I'll be talking about their the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act developments aside from Section 199 Cap A, what's going on there. And I'll be bouncing around. I have some dates in Tucson with the current federal tax developments and with ethics. I've got dates all over the place. I'll be in Minneapolis for the tax conference again this year. You know, I'm going all over the place here, you know, doing these days. Oh, by the way, Qualified Business Income, we'll also be doing that session day before Thanksgiving in Phoenix. So, and there are tons of other options your state CPA Society offers. Check your state CPA Society's offerings for what you can get this year. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments. Again, check our regular updates at www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We post there during the week. I hope to get some stuff written this week. I actually am not constantly on a plane or talking. I have Thursday. I've kind of got, because I have to try to get from cities, two cities that aren't super easy to get between. So I actually have Thursday to get from one to the other. So I actually probably have decent amount of time on Thursday to do some writing. So I'm hoping to get some stuff done there. So we'll talk about that. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Follow me on Twitter at edzollers. I also follow discussions on the subreddit, reddit.com/r/taxpros. I participate in discussion groups for the New Jersey Society of CPAs, the Arizona Society of CPAs, and the California Society of CPAs. Now, the Arizona, New Jersey ones, you have to be members of those organizations to participate. The Cal CPA one, Tax Talk, is open at this point to members from all across the country. So, you know, we have that, and we've talked about how to get into that before. You can email me if you want to know some more information about how to get to that group. But in any event, I look forward to this, where guidance is coming fast and furious. The IRS at the Bar Convention promised us over 1,000 pages of guidance by Thanksgiving. So that ought to be fun. Tons of reading coming up for you. I'm sure you all can't wait for the reading. So we'll try to keep up, see what's happening. And I look forward to seeing you at a course this year. And also, we're going to be following up each week here with current federal tax developments.